Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, I guess one small piece of good news is that the Republicans passed their cut, cap, and balance plan in the House on Tuesday night. It has almost no chance of passing in the Senate, but they're going to at least try and get a vote on it. Our actual good martini for the day is this exchange. It was just after the president announced he was all giddy about the Gang of Six plan. So we'll talk about that in a little bit in a different martini, as you might imagine. Jake Tapper of ABC News basically pointing out to Press Secretary Jay Carney, hey, Republicans in the House are going to pass their debt reduction plan tonight. It's not going to pass the Senate. The Senate has a couple of different plans, whether it's the Gang of Six or the Mitch McConnell backup plan that probably aren't going to get very far in the House. So
would this not be an opportune time for a president to lead and say this
leadership is not proposing a plan for the sake of having it voted up or down and likely voted down?
Jim, what happened to yes, we can? My gosh, the fact that it might be voted down means we don't even put up a plan at all. And I guess that's good news because, first of all, remember the mainstream media is actually calling out the Obama administration on the fact that he's demagogued this thing to death without actually having any concrete ideas of his own that the Congressional Budget Office and so forth could score. And it's good, once again, to point out to the American people that despite all the bluster, this president doesn't have a whole lot of substance on this issue in particular, but on a lot of issues in general.
The entire premise of the question is that no, Obama hasn't put forth a plan. And he hasn't. Every once in a while you hear somebody pointing out, Obama gave a speech in response to Ryan. He didn't put out a plan. The CBO famously said, we don't score speeches. Another good exchange I think illustrated this was Charles Krauthammer apparently got kind of irked by Nina Totenberg insisting that Obama had made big concessions in this debate. And he kept saying, all right, which ones? Name them. Tell us what cuts to entitlements has he been willing to make? And she says, well, you know, he's really taken heat from his allies. Taken heat from his allies over what? There's been nothing put down on paper. Everything is theoretical, or perhaps we should more say, everything is described in the format of leaks from unnamed White House staffers to members of the media. So at some point, if the President Obama wants to get credit for making the hard decisions, he's got to let us know what these hard decisions are, not just say, trust me, I'm making hard decisions behind closed doors, and you'll never know the details of them. Because when that's the story, we begin to think, oh, maybe he's not really making those hard decisions at all, as much as that would be nearly impossible to believe, considering what we know of the rest of Obama's presidency and his bold leadership in every other area.
Right.
It was kind of interesting. I love the fact that Carney's answer begins, leadership is not offering a plan. It sounded like one of those kind of, you know, back. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Mystery Men.
No.
Greg. But there's a character called the Sphinx who's giving these kind of faux Zen nuggets of wisdom that don't really make much sense when you think about it. And this sounded like one of those that only the brave man can show that he is scared. Or sometimes the courageous thing is to run away. And some of that. Sometimes true leadership comes from letting other people make the hard decisions and pay the price and then following them. That's leadership. And then, of course, what he says, you know, you don't offer a plan for the sake of offering a plan and saying this is my plan. All right. Don't say this is my starting point. Let's you know, start with this and work out from there. There's no reason that says Obama has to say my way or the highway. And no one's saying that he should say my way or the highway. We do want to say, all right, what's your way? Since you've spent a lot of time talking about how terrible the Republican option is and not put forth anything on paper for what his option is.
Absolutely. And if his fear of rejection, Jim, is so severe that he won't even offer a plan on an issue like this, what in the world is going to happen if for some reason he doesn't win re-election in 2012? That type of rejection could take him months or even years to recover from psychologically, because apparently the idea of somebody saying no to him just makes him curl up in the corner. So very, very.
Greg, I find your concern for Obama's psychological health touching. Who says we're just a bunch of partisan hacks? You care about this man. That's a beautiful thing. I need a moment. I'm tearing up over here. Sorry.
Absolutely. On to number two, and staying with the president. Yesterday, the Gang of Six, or is it seven? They come out with an idea. They plan to cut about $3.7 trillion over 10 years, reduce marginal rates, but make up for it with major deductions and loopholes being taken away from. A lot of conservatives saying this is just tax hikes to the tune of at least $1 trillion, if not more, and this is ridiculous. I knew it was bad because before I even knew that the bullet points were out, this guy was on my TV saying this.
That includes both spending cuts, modifications to Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare that would strengthen those systems and allow them to move forward, and would include a revenue component. We now have a bipartisan group of senators who agree with that balanced approach.
And these are not senators you would think of as being mealy-mouthed. We're talking Coburn, Saxby Chambliss, Mike Crapo, and one who was not part of the Gang of Six, Roger Wicker of Mississippi, calling it this triumph of statesmanship. The only good news, I guess, is that Harry Reid and Dick Durbin don't think they can actually put this on the table for a vote before August 2nd, so something else will end up getting voted on probably before then. But I don't know whether this is Republicans trying to just find common ground wherever possible or what it is, but it looks like a few of them are going to have a lot of explaining to do in conference.
So let me kind of take you through my thinking on this, Greg, and feel free to steer me correctly if you think I'm going down the wrong path.
But okay.
Because I remember you and I had pretty vehement disagreement over the McConnell plan.
Right.
Which I'm wondering if it's starting to look a little better in light of this. But let me take you through it. I begin with the preposition that Obama wants to hit the debt ceiling, that he wants the crisis, that he wants things to go wrong, because if he has that, he, despite all the terrible consequences, he will have a new scapegoat for the problems in the economy. If we are to hit the debt ceiling, if the markets tank, Obama will begin saying, see, Republicans ruined the economy. And will it work with the electorate? I don't know. But I think he finds, you know, anything he can do to muddy the waters about his own economic record, he considers to be a good thing. So I am not of the mindset that Obama is going to fold at the 11th hour. Leaving Republicans with no good options and several bad options. And of these, I kind of came to the conclusion the McConnell plan was the least bad option. And I find it still less bad than this Gang of Somewhere Between 5 and 8 plan, because their plan involves $1 trillion in tax hikes. It would be $1 trillion in tax hikes that Democrats were not willing to enact when they ran Congress because they feared the political price. And they're the tax hiking party. If Barack Obama can get Republicans to increase taxes by $1 trillion, the fallout amongst the Republican base will be enormous. I think they'll be disillusioned. I think they'll be depressed. I think you may see odd open, you know, civil war within the Republican Party. And I think it would be a serious complication to, never mind taking the White House in 2012. I think you would then really jeopardize the Republican Party keeping the House and getting any gains in 2012, because I think the base will say, why are we voting for these guys? We thought we were electing conservatives in 2010, and then they turned around and helped Obama enact tax hikes. So that's how I score all this. Feel free to set me straight on any of that.
I think, but for the most part, people would say tax increases means you've violated the very premise of the plan that you ran on. If they embrace the McConnell plan, it means you've done nothing to actually help solve the problem. You've only pushed it down the road. And we elected you basically for the status quo, which isn't going to be an acceptable response either. So it is a whole list of bad options. And I still think that for the most part, you'll have people, especially in the House, maybe even a handful or two in the Senate, who say if you prioritize the revenues coming in after August 2nd, that could put the pressure on people to make some actual serious cuts. If Obama's the one who decides not to actually pay the interest on the debt, then he will obviously be the one to blame if folks actually understand that. So
everything you're saying is perfectly right, Greg, but the problem is we're not dealing with somebody in the White House who wants to do that. I mean, I think Obama wants to not have Social Security checks go out. I think he wants as many far-ranging and dire economic consequences as possible. I'm not sure he can be able to blame that on Republicans. He certainly is going to try, and I think looking at how this debate has gone, I don't think it's that terribly unlikely. And then the next thing is that just for the sake of the country, I think the Republicans have to do something to avoid that scenario. But I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on you know, which disaster scenario is least harmful.
Quickly on to number three now. And this is a guy Jim and I generally like, especially on fiscal issues. But his campaign has been either horribly distracted or severely gone off course, depending on your perspective. Herman Cain, the pizza man, former CEO of Godfather's Pizza. But he's gotten bogged down in this issue over whether he would allow Muslims to be hired in the government. And now on Fox News Sunday, talking about the right to build mosques in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, if the local populace disagrees.
The people in the community know best. And I happen to side with the people in the community.
So you're saying any community, if they want to ban a mosque?
Yes, they have the right to do that. That's not discriminating based upon religion against their particular religion. That is an aspect of them building that mosque that doesn't get talked about. And the people in the community know what it is and they're talking about.
And of course, at first blush and probably at real blush, that would be a pretty severe violation of the First Amendment. It is a little bit of a thorny issue because you have these other countries, certainly like England and France, that have bent over backwards to be politically correct. And all of a sudden you do have Sharia law actually being applied in court. And all of a sudden the tenets of the democracy are threatened as a result of all of this accommodation. At the same time, of course, though, Jim, we do have the First Amendment. And that means that if folks follow the law, they should be able to worship freely. It's a little bit of a thorny issue, but I think certainly that he's being majorly distracted by this issue, and I think a lot of people, even his own party, are getting increasingly queasy about where he seems to be on this.
Yeah, I think he was exceptionally wrong on this, and it's not something I don't take pleasure in arguing that Herman Cain is very wrong on this. I wrote about this a bit in The Jolt, and I had lots and lots of people write in and tell me how wrong I was and how little I knew about Islam, even though I'd lived in Turkey for 2 years and been to mosques on three different continents and spent all kinds of time researching it and, you know, have read the Quran, etc. Because basically they came around the concept of Sharia. Now, look, is Sharia a threat to democracy? Absolutely. The problem is a lot of people say, well, by building this mosque, they're instituting Sharia. And I want to say, okay, how? You know, and at some point there's a dot there that never gets connected. How is the construction of a building and people practicing their faith become a ipso facto threat to democracy? Now, if they go into that, you know, some people said, well, if there's terrorists in there, it's a threat to democracy. Yes, and that's a crime. The crime is terrorism. The crime is action. The crime is not so much belief. And it's the idea that somehow going to a mosque and, you know, believing what Muslims believe is somehow by itself a threat to democracy basically gets into the realm of thought crimes. It's very Orwellian. It's, you know, we have a fairly, you know, clear line in this country, which is that, you know, your right to your First Amendment stops when your fist hits my nose. As soon as people start acting upon Sharia beliefs and the idea that we should not be a democracy, then it's a crime, then we can prosecute, then we can deal with it as is. But the idea that, you know, just by even, you know, even speech, unless it is, you know, very meets a very strict definition of being not really provocative, but inciting violence, you know, there's as far as I'm concerned, there's no government role to do in here. I think Cain is really opening a very dangerous can of worms here, which is the idea that if he really believes that the standard should not be a, you know, across-the-board definition of the First Amendment, the idea that local community standards should define what is an acceptable practice of religion and what is not, then what happens to a conservative evangelical or Catholic church in Manhattan or San Francisco or out in Berkeley? What if they say, you know what, you guys are praying to protect the unborn, and that just doesn't hold the community standards here, and so we want you to stop. I mean, what Cain is calling for here is basically a wholesale rethinking of the First Amendment, and it's not one that I find appealing, and I cannot imagine that even amongst Republican primary voters, this is something they're really itching at. I mean, if Sharia really is a threat to America, then we can deal with Sharia as Sharia. We don't have to wholeheartedly undo our basic concepts of religious freedom in this country in order to do it.
Well, I think a lot of people seem to agree with that, and I know a lot of folks are obviously very concerned about the fact that a lot of radicalization seems to be going on in the mosques, but as you mentioned, that certainly can be monitored. So it's an interesting issue, and we'll see how much traction it continues to get, at least in terms of the dialogue in this campaign, but it has certainly been a major topic of conversation from the Cain campaign. So, Jim, very interesting on all three topics today. We'll do it again tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.